Yannick Gazzotti versus People, case number 2011 SC 264, set for 30 minutes, 15 minutes per side. The appellant will have to keep track of your time. Please state your name when you start. And again, for those of you that weren't here, some of us are using our iPads, which have the briefs and our notes and links to Westlaw. So just be aware that we're paying attention and not searching the internet. Please proceed.
Good morning. I'm Anthony Noble and I represent the petitioner, Yannick Gazzotti. The issue before the court is whether there's a right to post-conviction review of a deferred judgment. This is an issue of statutory interpretation, and the court's primary task when interpreting a statute is to give effect to the intent of the legislature. The legislature's intent is set forth in the statute, and that's to provide a right to anyone who is convicted of a criminal offense to apply for post-conviction review. This court, in numerous cases, has identified that there are two purposes of post-conviction review. The first one is to prevent constitutional injustice, and the second one is to bring finality to the conviction. The court is faced with three interpretations in this case. The first interpretation is from the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled that there's no right to post-conviction review of a deferred judgment unless the deferred judgment is revoked and a judgment of conviction is entered. The second interpretation is the Attorney General's interpretation, which is that there is no right to post-conviction review of a deferred judgment under Rule 35C, but there is a right to move to withdraw the guilty plea under Rule 32D. Then the third interpretation is that a deferred judgment should be treated like any other conviction and have and there be a right to post-conviction review, just like there is for any other type of conviction. Neither the Court of Appeals interpretation nor the Attorney General's interpretation gives effect to the legislature's intent. I'd first like to address the Court of Appeals interpretation. I think the biggest problem with the Court of Appeals interpretation is demonstrated by Mr. Gazzotti's case, in which he pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor and a felony, and he was given probation for the misdemeanor and a deferred judgment for the felony. Under the Court of Appeals interpretation, he can apply for post-conviction review of the misdemeanor, but he cannot apply for post-conviction review of the deferred judgment. So in his case, he can file a 35C motion, have a post-conviction hearing, the court could find that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, but he still has the deferred judgment, which renders him deportable. Now, if his deferred judgment at some point is revoked, then under the Court of Appeals interpretation, he can file another 35C motion, have another evidentiary hearing, bring in the same witnesses, present the same evidence, hopefully get the same ruling to get the remedy that he needs for the ineffective assistance of counsel. So the Court of Appeals interpretation under those circumstances creates an inefficiency in the administration of justice. I think one of the other problems with the Court of Appeals interpretation is someone in Mr. Gazzotti's position may not ever revoke, may never get the deferred judgment revoked. So it puts him in a difficult position, and it puts his attorney in a difficult position, because we know that he needs this remedy because he's going to be deported. But the only way that we can get this remedy is for him to commit some kind of law violation.
I interrupt you right there, just because your time is sort of short and you've hit a kind of a nodal point there. You say the only way he could get the remedy he needs. But hasn't the prosecution in their brief offered an alternate that on its face would seem to provide him that remedy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would provide a remedy, assuming, though, that the court does grant counsel or does grant an evidentiary hearing, because under Rule 32D, there's no right to counsel, there's no right to an evidentiary hearing, and there's no obligation on the court to make findings of fact or conclusions of law.
Let me interrupt you right there. Admittedly, that's a discretionary standard under 32, which could actually be to the advantage of a defendant, because he wouldn't have to establish a constitutional violation. But let me turn it around. Would a judge ever not abuse his discretion if it were established for him that there was actually ineffective assistance or a violation, constitutional violation with regard to entry of the plea?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we have to get to that stage where we can present the evidence. And as you can see, the difficulty in Ms. Gazzardi's case is we couldn't even get to the hearing and present the evidence. So a court on the pleadings alone may determine that or exercise its discretion and say, you know, I'm not appointing counsel, I'm not giving you an evidentiary hearing because I have complete discretion. Whereas under Rule 35C, the court doesn't have that discretion. It has to follow the procedures set forth in Rule 35C.
I'm sorry, did I miss something? Did you all try the 32 route?
No, Your Honor. We filed a 35C motion, and the court actually set the motion for an evidentiary hearing, but then when we turned up to the court had decided that there was no prejudice because of the Rule 11 advisement form. So that's...
Well, can I, again, because time is short, what do we do with Carbajal and the statement in Carbajal that we made?
I think Judge Torban, in his dissent, explains how Carbajal is not really on point because the court wasn't determined whether or not there was a right to post-conviction review.
It's dicta, but yet we said it.
Sorry?
It's certainly dicta, if that's your point.
Yeah, that's
but
my
we
point,
did say it.
So I think that Carbajal can be distinguished, you know, on that basis. So the court was looking at whether or not it could review an application under Rule 21, whether there was an appropriate appellate remedy. So it's really not on point to this case. And also, as Judge Tubman in his dissent stated, that in Carbajal, the court wasn't looking at the legislative intent for post-conviction review. So there's a problem with the Court of Appeals interpretation, because it puts somebody in Mr. Cazardi's position where he has to have either two separate hearings, or he has to do something to get that deferred judgment revoked so that he can have a hearing on the a post-conviction hearing on the deferred judgment. Now, the more serious problem is for the person who successfully completes the deferral period, because that's the person who has done everything they're supposed to do. They've complied with all the terms and conditions. They've successfully completed the deferred judgment. And what happens if they find out that that deferred judgment now renders them deportable, and that they find out that they weren't properly advised by their attorney? They have absolutely no remedy available to them. They don't even have the option that Mr. Cazardi has, which is to get the deferred judgment revoked.
I wonder if this is really the case for that, though. We have an advisement here that's written, and he signed off on it. I mean, this isn't exactly the right case for this proposition, is it? I mean...
Although, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals did say that, did indicate that that advisement doesn't prevent Mr. Cazardi from getting an evidentiary hearing. And there are numerous courts throughout the country that have interpreted Padilla and looked at similar advisements in different jurisdictions and determined that that doesn't disprove prejudice. So, you know, that may be a factor, that may not in this case, but I think that the district court on remand, if this case is remand, would not find that there was a lack of prejudice or that advisement disproves prejudice. So for those two scenarios, someone who hasn't had the deferred judgment revoked and someone that has, the Court of Appeals interpretation doesn't give effect to the intent of the legislature, which is to prevent constitutional injustice. The bigger problem that the court may see with the Court of Appeals interpretation is the other intent of the legislature, which is to bring finality to judgment. if the Court of Appeals is correct and Mr. Kazadi cannot file 35C until his deferred judgment is revoked, assuming that he gets through near the end of the deferred judgment, and in his case it could be extended to 4 years plus another 180 days for restitution purposes, he may then have an additional 3 years on top of that to file his 35C motion. In his case, there's a real urgency, though, to get the plea withdrawn, but there could be cases where there's this four-year or longer than four-year extension on the already, the three-year time limitation that's already given under the statute. In cases where people have pleaded guilty to sex offenses, there's an additional 2 years on top of the 4 years, so it could be almost 10 years or longer than 10 years until the court gets to hear the 35C motion. So that defeats the legislative intent of bringing finality to judgment. So the Court of Appeals interpretation doesn't give effect to both intents of the legislator to prevent constitutional injustice and to bring finality to judgment. The Attorney General's interpretation has some similar problems as well. First, there are going to be two separate proceedings. In Mr. Kazadi's case, we're going to have, well, we should have filed both a 35C motion for the misdemeanor and then a 32D motion for the deferred judgment. Under those circumstances, the court's going to have mixed standards of reviews, different types of discretion, and there could also be the possibility that, you know, there are two separate hearings, a 35C hearing followed by a 32D hearing, or a 32D followed by a 35C. And then, again, the problems with 32D is there's no right to counsel, no right to an evidentiary hearing, the court doesn't have to make findings of facts or conclusions of law. It has complete discretion on whether or not to provide any kind of relief.
Mr. Noble, can I ask you a question? If you get the 35C hearing, do you not have an issue with regard to the second prong? Because then they have to, then the court has to look at the sufficiency of the evidence to determine whether, do you think that's an issue, or am I off base on that?
Your Honor, that may be an issue when we get down to the district court for the evidentiary hearing. I'm not sure that issue is really before the court at the moment, but it's the kind of issue that district courts are used to dealing with in 35C motions, so it shouldn't really be a problem.
The reason I bring it up is because you're talking about the sufficiency of the remedy under the 32 rule versus the 35 rule, and I'm wondering if the 35C is a little bit of be careful what you wish for.
Yes, Your Honor, I can understand that, but at the same time, with Rule 35C, we do get all of these procedural protections that we just don't get in Rule 32D. And then if we don't get what we wish for in the district court, we can go to the Court of Appeals and we get de novo review rather than an abuse of discretion standard. The other problem with the Attorney General's interpretation is that, again, it doesn't give effect to the legislator's intent to bring finality to judgments of conviction. Under Rule 32D, again, a four-year deferred term could be imposed. That could be extended to 6 years or 6.5 years, depending on the kind of case. And if the deferred judgment is revoked towards the end of that term, then it could be that the 32D motion is filed up to six and a half years after the guilty plea was entered. So that doesn't address the legislator's concern of bringing finality to judgment. The worst case scenario is when somebody actually successfully completes the deferred judgment, because sentence is never imposed. So under the Attorney General's argument, you know, it could be 50 years or longer and the motion would still be timely because sentence hasn't been imposed. So neither the Court of Appeals interpretation nor the Attorney General's interpretation gives effect to the intent of the legislature.
Say that again, Mr. Noble. Just repeat about 50 years argument.
Under Rule 32D, the motion is timely if it's filed before the sentence is imposed.
Right.
So the only way to give effect to the legislature's intent in this case is to treat a deferred judgment like any other conviction and allow defendants to file under Rule 35C.
Would that same rationale allow an appeal of a plea?
Yeah, because that's allowed under Rule 35C. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075, and I represent the people in this matter. The issue before this court is very narrow. Both the positions of the defendant and the people offer trial court and appellate review. The only issue before this court is how to reach such review. Under the defendant's position, this court would be forced to not only reverse its precedents, but would have to alter the framework of our post-conviction review system, giving the statutes and rules a meaning never intended. Excuse me. The people's position, however, alleviates that concern. Looking at 18.1.4.10.35C and 16.5.402 together, they indicate that the defendant is not entitled to post-conviction review of his deferred judgment because sentence has not occurred and a judgment of conviction has not entered. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold. Even though sentencing has not occurred, the defendant points to the language in 18.1.4.10.1 and 35C2, which state, notwithstanding the fact that no review of a conviction of crime was sought by appeal within the time prescribed, every person convicted of a crime is entitled to, as a matter of right, to make application for post-conviction review. However, CRIMP 35C3, in referring to that specific language, states, one who is aggrieved in claiming either a right to be released or to have a judgment of conviction set aside on one or more of the grounds enumerated in Section C2 of this rule may file a motion in the court. Therefore, the language of the rule implies that the legislature and this court contemplated that a judgment of conviction was necessary for post-conviction review. Furthermore, since both the statute and the rule state, notwithstanding the fact that no review of a conviction was sought, they imply that an appeal at least could have been sought. Not that a direct appeal was not permissible. And to talk about the legislative intent, I believe that 16.5.402 shows the legislative intent because 16.5.402 limits the time in which you can collaterally attack an appeal. And if you interpret the way in 16.5.402 would apply to deferred judgments, both of these ways lead to absurd results. If the time period on 16.5.402 would start running when the defendant pleads guilty, then the defendant could be outside the time limits of 16.5.402 before his judgment, deferred judgment could even be completed. And if the time period never starts running, then 16.5.402 would serve no purpose at all. And then I believe it's well recognized that in the context of 16.5.402, the time for collateral attacking conviction does not begin until after an appeal is exhausted or after sentencing, if there's no appeal.
Well, is it good practice or is there a duty on defense counsel to advise a person in this person's situation that deportation may result?
Are you talking about the Sixth Amendment deficiency claim?
I'm talking about the circumstance. He's claiming that he wasn't informed by his counsel about the deportation status, right?
Correct.
That could result. So what's the standard we hold attorneys to in this state regarding that issue when they're advising someone with regard to a guilty plea or a deferred judgment?
Well, I think people v. Pozo and Padilla v. Kentucky explain the issue of when deportation consequences are, I think they say presumptively mandatory, then a counsel has the right or has the obligation to inform the defendant of those consequences. But Padilla doesn't address the prejudice prong, is what I believe Justice Boatwright was referring to earlier. But as far as the claim here, I don't think that the people are disputing that for his misdemeanor charge, he could not have raised that claim. And I think that since we did not go for cert on the misdemeanor charge, that the Court of Appeals reversed based on deficient performance. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. I'm just trying to determine how, if no conviction or judgment is entered, your basis there, how we enforce the duty and basically to inform the person of these very important consequences.
I think that you can file an ineffective of counsel claim under 32D, and since sentencing hasn't occurred here, then the defendant still has that avenue.
Thank you.
respond to opposing counsel's comments about the differences both in the discretion that's inherent in 32D, the fact that there is no right to counsel in a 32D claim, and the fact that the standard of review is abuse of discretion under 32D, and how does that impact the adequacy of that avenue as one for relief?
Well, I think as Judge Gabriel pointed out in his opinion, 35C doesn't guarantee a right for an avenue of relief for all situations. And also, 32D, a denial of a 32D can still be, the defendant can still file a Rule 21 in this court for a denial of a 32D, I believe. So he would still be getting appellate review if he believed that the trial court had abused its discretion.
What is your sense of the impact of the specific circumstances here? In other words, I understood Amicus to be requesting that an exception be made for non-citizen defendants who were facing deportation. I understand defense counsel to be basically creating a broad exception that anyone who has had a deferred entered ought to be able to file a 35C. What is your sense of what other circumstances other than this deportation circumstance would a defendant be in a position of needing to file a 35C?
Well, our position is that there should not be an exception through 35C because sentencing has not occurred and the review is through 32D. And I'm not really sure like what other types of situations that a defendant would be put in that would create an exception under the Amicus brief, but I would address that as far as the 35C exception that defense counsel points to, which is bring finality to judgments of conviction. Here, there is no judgment of conviction, so prevent constitutional injustice for a judgment of conviction. And I don't think that there is a judgment of conviction here.
Can you walk us through kind of the statutory analysis, noting that we have Carbajal, the phrase in 35C and in the statute doesn't say judgment of conviction, and yet the Court of Appeals interpretation of that imports judgment of conviction. Can you walk us through kind of the statutory basis for why that's an appropriate statutory interpretation that doesn't rely on our prior case law?
Well, I think that they both 18.1.4.10 does use the words judgment of conviction throughout it in some parts. In that one part, it says every person convicted of a crime, but if you look at how 35C3 interprets C2, it refers to the language in C2 as a judgment of conviction. And then along with the statutory, the 16.5.402 that attaches itself to 35C, I believe that interpretation necessarily implies that a judgment of conviction is necessary for collaterally attacking is necessary for the interpretation that the statute actually means judgment of conviction, if that makes sense. And I guess as far as your question about the Amicus brief, I think that goes over how federal case law interprets their own law. And I guess my position is that the state statute shouldn't be informed by the federal case law and how the federal case law interprets their own law. Is that kind of your earlier question, or
my broader context question was, I was just wondering how often this really comes up. I certainly understand the nature of the catch-22 that arises right in this deportation set of circumstances, but I'm wondering, sort of outside of that, where it is important to attack the deferred judgment because it has collateral consequences in the immigration context, are there other situations in which someone who had received a deferred would need to collaterally attack it through 35C, and I wasn't readily coming up with examples.
I'm not really sure about examples. I do know that it's very rare that somebody, and a defendant, would want to get out of his deferred judgment because it's a privilege. You have the opportunity to get a felony conviction, your guilty plea withdrawn. So I don't think that it arises very much that somebody would want to collaterally attack their deferred judgment.
Right, and I guess the reason I'm asking that question is, okay, if we were to interpret those words differently to not require judgment of conviction, would we be seeing sort of a flood of 35C motions in deferred judgment situations, or would it really be restricted as a practical matter to this immigration context?
Well, I think that you're right. Maybe it would be restricted only to people in these specific situations, but I do think that if you choose that route, it has some unintended consequences for other defendants that, you know, if you can file a post-conviction motion at any point after you've been convicted by a jury, before you even are sentenced, or does your 16-5-402 clock start running then because a deferred judgment or intended conviction, does it start running right when you get convicted and not after the judgment of conviction enters? So, if it doesn't affect in that way a small, if it only affects a small class of defendants, it may affect a larger class of defendants in an unintended way. And I guess that leads me into some of the other policy reasons. I do think that a deferred judgment is a privilege, and it's something that the prosecutor and the defendant, when they enter into them, kind of work together, and it's a benefit to the defendant. So there's also an unintended consequence that a prosecutor may hesitate to offer deferred judgments in the future, or even more alarming, would hesitate to offer deferred judgments to defendants who are non-citizens. And then if there are no further questions, I guess that you're fine. Oh, do you have another question?
Oh, that's fine. Thank you very much. Rebuttal, Mr. Noble?
There are many different interpretations of the word conviction, judgment of conviction, and for the most part there is some consistency that a conviction includes a deferred judgment. But really, the crux job here is not a technical interpretation of words in the statute. It's to try and give this statute legislative the effect, the intent of the legislature, which is here to prevent constitutional injustice and to bring finality to convictions. And I think Mr. Cazada's case is an example where the interpretation, well, at least the Court of Appeals interpretation of the statute, denies him of constitutional justice because he was denied effective assistance of counsel and he's suffering severe consequences as a result of that ineffective assistance. He's going to be deported, he's going to be excluded from the country for the rest of his life, he's going to be separated from his family. So under those circumstances, the legislature's intent has not been affected by that interpretation of the statute. The only way that that intent can be affected is by allowing him the right to post-conviction review, just as the statute allows anyone else convicted of a crime that right to post-conviction review. So it asks the court to interpret the statute to allow a right to post-conviction review of a deferred judgment.
Thank you. What you're after really is this evidentiary hearing, right? You're after the evidentiary hearing. I mean, we can't assume that the counsel didn't tell him. I mean, it's alleged that he didn't tell him.
No, Your Honor, but because he's alleged that in his 35C motion, then those allegations have to be accepted as true.
I understand that. I'm looking at the withdrawal of the guilty plea context that the judge is being asked to consider, and can the judge consider ineffective assistance of counsel in that context?
Under what context?
Withdrawal of the guilty plea.
Under Rule 32D, yes, Your Honor, court can. I mean, there are a number of decisions from, I'm not sure if it's this court or the Court of Appeals, in which it's been found that ineffective assistance of counsel is a fair and just reason under Rule 32D for withdrawal of the guilty plea.
I think your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just some other question. Finally, did you want to say anything additional?
No.
All right. Thank you both for your argument, the briefs. The case will be submitted on the briefs.